Okay, this is Gary Parrish, and it's the Eye on College Basketball podcast again. And I'm talking to you now on the morning of December 23rd, which I suppose is the eve of Christmas Eve. And because it's Monday, I'm joined by my CBS colleagues Jeff Borzello and Matt Norlander. Matt Norlander, how are you, young man?
Well, I'm okay, actually. First of all, it's Festivus, so if we want to air any grievances at the end of the podcast, we can totally do that. Secondly, I'm limping into Christmas here, buddies. I played some hoops over the weekend.
Oh, God.
And, yeah, totally high ankle sprain. Chris Mortensen's reporting I'm out for 2 to 4. I got to confirm that with Lock 'em 4 later. But, yeah, I am brutally – tennis ball ankle, it's gone down, but – yeah, man, it was rough.
Why are you damaging yourself on a Christmas weekend? Like, what are you doing? Like, at what point? Yeah. I'll bump into a friend of mine, and he'll be like on crutches, and I'm like, so what were you doing? And he's like, oh, I was playing football. I'm like, what are you doing playing football? We're all old, like, and unathletic, and we don't get paid to do that anyway. Like, what are you doing? Like, can't you just pick up golf?
Well, I am getting old and not paid to do that. I wouldn't say unathletic. But, yeah, I dipped out, honestly, for like 30 minutes on Saturday. Once Kentucky and John Calipari proved himself to be a much superior coach to Rick Byrd.
Oh, wow. That must have been something for you to see. Did you have what was it like for you to see that with your own eyes?
It was very tough, actually. Yeah, I could
you have your whiteboard out and everything?
I had the whiteboard out. And, I had all sorts of stuff going on. But, yeah, so anyway, I dipped out real quick for – I live right next to my gym, my LA Fitness, and got a quick game in. And certainly enough, this 6'5", 230-pound dude comes bowling down the lane, and here I am thinking I'm freaking Joel Embiid trying to block the shot.
Oh, God.
And I come down on, you know, three different sets of shoes, and it was just one of those
not only did you play basketball, you're trying to block big dudes and get in the lane and draw charges. You're trying to do all that.
I told Borzello this. Like, the best guy on the floor was like, yo, dog, you good. And I was like, oh, that's all I need, man. I was like, okay, that's because, you know, I'm a tall, awkward white guy, and obviously there are misconceptions before I step on the floor.
Yeah, you got a little Dirk Nowitzki to your game.
I got a little Dirk Borzello saw it firsthand at the Final Four. But anyway, between that and then of course my Chicago Bears freaking just
that was a mess, huh?
Oh man, it's just. And the thing is, like, they're going to lose to the Packers. It's going to be the worst. I can't stand the Packers, and Rodgers is going to come back. So next Sunday, I'm going to be really just not in the mood to talk on the podcast.
Oh, God, and that's presumably when you'll have two good ankles.
I will be a little bit better then.
See, I struggle with the idea of, like, going out and hooping. You know, like, hey, let's go hoop. Because I you're exactly right. There are, like, if I saw you walk into a basketball court, I would go, what is he doing? Like, why are you even doing this? And so I think I've reached the age where I don't like to do anything where, from a distance, if somebody saw – or up close, if somebody saw me doing it, it would just look stupid. Like, what is he doing? And basketball would quite clearly fit into that. Like, I could play golf because, like, if you give me, you know, I got the proper shorts and the proper shirt and the proper hat and the proper glove. And so I'm not a great golfer. I'm not even a good golfer. But I look like a golfer. Like, if you saw me standing around, like, pretending like getting ready to play golf, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know I'm not great. You wouldn't know I am, but you'd have to wait and see. Whereas if I walked on a basketball court, you could probably make an intelligent assumption that I'm just not going to be good. And so I don't walk myself into those situations. It's really why at this point I only play golf and wiffle ball. That's it.
Yeah, I was about to say, well, like, you get into that wiffle ball game. You
know, I know, like, but like I look like a wiffle ball star when I walk on the
field. Yes, you know
what?
Borzello can attest to this because we actually hit the batting cages. Like,
oh yeah, I remember that.
Parrish is like legitimately an extremely good baseball player. Yeah, like,
yeah, you
he was
pop.
Smacking that.
That was my favorite.
70 miles an hour off the cage.
Goodman kept wanting to go to the 90 mile an hour.
That was one of my favorite parts of that Vegas trip. Besides seeing who did we go see? Dead Mouse.
Okay,
so we went to see Dead Mouse. That was fun.
I told you guys it wouldn't be good. You should have listened to me.
We had a fun night. That was a fun night.
That was a good night.
It was a fun night. You realize it sounds stupid to pay $2,000 to get a table, but In hindsight, that was a pretty good money well spent, I thought.
It was a great investment.
Really I thought was. It was a terrific investment. And so we saw Deadmau5. That was fun. But also we were at the – what was it called? The what was that gym called that we were at?
It was the thing that was run by Chris Paul and all those
Yeah,
dudes.
Well, it was a Nike event where they took some Nike summer basketball teams, and then they had Nike professional players basically coach them. So you had Chris Paul coaching a team and Carmelo Anthony coaching a team. And I remember Anthony Davis also being there. Ty Lawson was there. And it's, but in, this was like a full – so they had this like basketball complex, and that's where all this was at. But like behind the basketball complex, they had pitching machines, like a batting cages. And the field, to the extent that there's a field, you're not really playing the field at a batting cage, but they had fences and stuff that was sort of like Fenway Park, right? They had the big green monster and stuff. And so we, in a break in games, and I'll be honest, there's no need to lie. I think it was actually during some games. We just
It was at Impact Academy.
Right.
Yeah.
We decided we'd go hit baseballs. And so you guys got this. And keep in mind, hitting a wiffle ball is way different than hitting a baseball. And if you haven't hit a baseball in a decade, it's weird. But I you know, I don't want to sit here and brag about myself, but I was crushing a little bit.
You had some power. You were hitting the wall.
You didn't have to say I was hitting the wall. You could have said I was hitting it over the wall.
I think you did hit the wall.
Oh, I hit the wall several times, but I could not get it over the monster. I couldn't get it over the monster, but I blamed the bat. I was using somebody else's.
Yeah, blame the bat.
It was a bad, but it was an inferior bat. The bat wasn't up to my so I don't do things. So, like, here's my deal. If there would have been an extra basketball court, like right beside the basketball court, and Carmelo and Chris Paul were standing out there, and y'all were like, "Yo, man, hey, why don't we play 3-on-3 real quick?" I just said, "No, I can't do that because I'm not interested in looking stupid." I walked into that batting cage with confidence. I cannot walk into a basketball court.
You wouldn't have played 3-on-3 with Chris Paul and Carmelo if they asked you to.
Well, first off, let's start here. Why, under what scenario would they ask me to play
you
basketball?
You just said they're standing on the
court.
No,
if they were standing on the court like coaching their teams and there was an open court. Right.
Well,
and
I thought in your hypothetical they're asking you to play and you're saying no.
Okay, let's have a new hypothetical. What if Chris Paul asked me to join the Clippers? So anyway, I don't understand Matt Norlander playing basketball, but I'm glad you're relatively okay, and I hope that you're walking without a limp. Again, very soon. Borzello, what's up with you? I can tell just by the non-echo in your voice that you're not at home.
I am at my parents in Wilmington, North Carolina. It's quite a change.
Why do your parents live in Wilmington, North Carolina?
Because they moved from Long Island when I got out of college, and now they live down here, and it's warmer, and it's I don't know. I guess more relaxing. I don't know. I mean, I like it down here. I prefer Long Island, but.
No, I'm not. I have nothing against North Carolina. I was thinking about that as I knew you were in North Carolina or going to North Carolina. I was like, okay, so he's from New York, and that means his parents are probably from New York. So why is he in North Carolina? I didn't know, but now
they
I
moved
know.
when they retired 3-4 years ago. They moved down here. North Carolina is like the new Florida for New York people to retire to.
Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are moving down to North Carolina as opposed to Florida. I guess Florida's too humid or something. I don't know.
I can't.
Florida's just too Florida. I think that's
yeah,
that's
pretty much. I think it's got a little stigma about it now. Florida, so.
Is that true? Wow, I had no idea. I didn't know. Well, all right. Well, listen, we had an interesting weekend of college basketball just wrapped up, and we're going to talk about it. We got an interesting weekend of college basketball ahead of us, and we're going to talk about that. But I wanted to start with the big development that led us into the weekend, which was. News that P.J. Harrison is definitely done at North Carolina and that North Carolina will not seek reinstatement for him. In other words, after investigating this on its end and after the NCAA did its preliminary round of conversations, I suppose, North Carolina decided it's not even worth trying to seek reinstatement. What do you guys make of that development?
Well, I guess not terribly surprised. A certain part of me believed that he would, get on the court later this season. But then if we had talked about this a week ago, I would have thought that. But then when we learned of McDonald getting back on the court, immediately eligible for that Texas game last Wednesday night. And then the report from Yahoo saying Harrison was likely to miss the season, not only because of Yahoo's track record with reporting, but just...
What about the report from CBSSports.com a month ago that said Harrison was likely to miss the season?
That was also...
Did you read that one?
That was also a report.
That was a good one.
was also a report worth taking into consideration.
I was like, on Friday, I guess this was Friday, right? Or Thursday, whenever it was. So Norlander's like, I'll take this Yahoo report. I'm like, okay, I got to go read this Yahoo report. And you know what the Yahoo report was? It looks like PJ Harrison's not going to play this year. And I'm like, I reported that a month ago.
It's your track record, Parrish. What?
My track record's impeccable, if you don't mind.
Listen, your reporting went without saying. I was just talking within the context of last week and this unfolding. That's all.
Well, I'm glad that you were so excited to read a month after I wrote that PJ Harrison was probably never going to play at North Carolina.
All right,
again
in short, didn't expect him to play. The statement his family released was really short-sighted. I think it does affect Carolina in the big picture, even though they've been good without him, they struggle without him. I think ultimately they're going to be like a 5 seed, maybe a 4 seed at best, because they're going to have some bad losses compared with good wins. And I think he'll be, I don't know, he'll maybe be a backup at the NBA level because of his shooting ability, but I don't think he's going to like walk in and be an impact player in the NBA in the next 5 years.
I think it's weird that I think a few people on Twitter asked, and I don't know, they asked you, Parrish, I know they asked me, you know, why can't Harrison come back next year? Like, Harrison's not going to come back next year. He's done. Like, they should just get over it. He's going to the NBA or whatever he's going to do. There's zero chance he's going to play in college next year. And I just, it's interesting to me that some people think he's still going to come back.
I run into
one more year.
I run into this on Twitter all the time, and it sort of distorts your view of quote people, because I got a lot of the same questions. What you find out is that, you know, out of, I don't know how many Twitter followers you have, how many do you have, Borzella?
24.5.
okay, so when you have something like, so I got like 76 or 77,
yeah, all right,
or something
whatever.
Like that. And so here's my point, besides rubbing it in that I've like tripled
seriously
it. The point is that there's like, not all those people are smart. They're just not. In fact, I'm not sure half of them are. All right, and yet the ratio of smart people I meet in real life relative to smart people I meet on Twitter is like way out of whack. It's just weird. And so what happens is you get these questions from people, and you go, God, everybody doesn't really understand this. And the truth is, everybody does understand it. It's just
except the five people that
it's just these five idiots that don't get it.
let's not go down this Twitter road again, Parrish.
So that's what happens. So I do this all the time. I go, because I actually went into I did this really quickly on Friday. I wrote something really quick, and I want to talk to you guys about that in a moment. And then I ran into radio real quick, so I had to go do a radio show. And so as I was driving, I was sort of like looking at my mentions. And I was like, my God, people just don't get this. And then I had to sit back over the weekend and go, you know what? Yes, they do. Everybody gets this. It's just these right. five idiots that don't understand it. And so I got the same questions you got. As soon as this happened, it was like, so is PJ Harrison coming back next year? No. What part of North Carolina is not? Okay, he's currently ineligible according to the NCAA, period. North Carolina has decided they are not even going to ask for him to be reinstated. That means he'll never play at North Carolina again, because they will never again ask for him to be reinstated. Do you really not understand that? But I got that question five different times. Then it was like, okay, could he transfer? In theory, yes, he could transfer and sit out a year and all that stuff. But if North Carolina doesn't think it's worth asking for reinstatement, you know, North Carolina just didn't decide. And I guess this is the biggest misconception. And the thing that frustrated me about the families statement. North Carolina didn't just decide that it doesn't want PJ Harrison on its basketball team. You know, North Carolina loves basketball, and North Carolina has, for better or worse, shown over the past few years that they're willing to shove things to the side in the spirit of athletics. Suddenly this is an athletic department or a university that doesn't want its most talented basketball player on the team. That's just silly. I don't understand why people think that. The truth is that they recognized the truth is a combination of these two things. First off, PJ Harrison wasn't honest with North Carolina's own investigators, with its own compliance department, which I think pissed people off. You know, they were like, "Hold on, we're gonna fight for this kid. F this kid. If they're not gonna tell the truth to us, then go." You know, and beyond that, he wasn't honest with NCAA investigators either. At which point, whether it's Des Bryant or Bruce Pearl, we know that there's a track record for listen, you could commit violations and we'll try to work with you on that. That's what happened with Leslie McDonald. But if you are not honest with us, you are done. And so I guess the family statement that just sort of struck me odd was that they said it was shameful that North Carolina wouldn't even try to ask for reinstatement. And I think that the word isn't shameful. I think it's smart because it saves a what could become a very public situation with the details of all of the transgressions that PJ Hairston, let's just say, might have had. And beyond that, it would have been a massive waste of time because North Carolina either decided after this kid wasn't honest with us, we're not going to reinstate him, or after this kid was dishonest with us and the NCAA, we now know that the NCAA is not going to reinstate him. Either way, to me, the idea that they didn't ask for reinstatement suggests just how bad this was.
Yeah, if they thought there was any chance he could have been reinstated, like if they thought they had any chance of having him play at all during his next 3 months, they obviously would have tried to get him reinstated. And I think it was too risky. I mean, like you said, a lot of those details could have come out. You know, people could start digging into it more. Now they're cutting ties. They're saying, all right, it's done. Like, we're moving on without him. I think it's smart. They don't need us hanging over their head anymore. And after every game, okay, when's PJ Hairston going to come back? When are you going to know about PJ Hairston? What's he going to do when he comes back? Now, you know, they're done with him. They can move on. And, you know, they struggle a little bit on Saturday. But now they know this is their team going forward. It's Leslie McDonald plus whatever they had for the first 2 months of the year. And now they can go into ACC play without this hanging over their head.
I did find it interesting, just one last quick thing for me on this, how things had changed so dramatically from the AD telling Carolina faculty in September Hairston would definitely be back on the court. Hairston himself telling, I think it was the student newspaper, less than 2 weeks later that he also had every intention and belief that he would be back on the court. And from where we were in late September to how that just dramatically changed over the course of Carolina's investigation, I just thought was something notable. Because I remember when Bubba Cunningham said that, it kind of changed the prism for UNC fans who thought, okay, no, this really won't end up being a huge deal. You know, he'll be back for the Kentucky game. Well, that didn't happen, obviously. And now at least Carolina has closure, I guess you could say, with this issue, and they can go forward and be the most confusing team ever. Well, so that's fun.
Here's the part that I think people, some people don't grasp. Because I've had people, for the most part, I think North Carolina fans, I think for the most part, North Carolina fans are okay with this. They sort of understand why this had to be and sort of understand that PJ did this to himself. But there's still a few people who think maybe North Carolina should have, quote, fought for PJ Hairston. Here's my understanding of what the way this went down, because there was a time, and this was sort of my column from, by the way, Norlana, you could look it up. It's actually dated November 23rd, where I wrote that PJ Hairston was probably never going to play for North Carolina again. Just Google it when we're through here. Because I went back and looked at all the quotes from like July, August, September. And then there was a moment where the answers started changing. In other words, there was a time in the preseason where nobody even entertained the idea that PJ Hairston would never play again. In fact, I remember talking to somebody, let's just say close to the North Carolina program, and they were like, listen, like, you know, he's an idiot. He was doing something that he shouldn't have been doing, but like, it ain't that big of a, like, we'll get through it. Like, he'll play again. Like, you know, it's going to look bad and people are going to call him a cheater and they might call us cheaters and all that stuff, but he'll play again. Like, it wasn't even on the table that he would never play again. And then suddenly, I don't want to say suddenly, but eventually the answer started to be, well, we'll see. Well, I don't know. Like Roy Williams, you know, when I was at the Mohegan Sun, he was like, I don't know if I'll ever coach him again. And I asked that question the way I asked it for very specific reasons, because at that point I was under the impression, because the people I had been talking to all along, their answers had changed. They had gone from, yeah, it is what it is, but he'll be back and it'll be fine, to, we don't know anymore. And I wanted to see in a very public way if Roy Williams' answer would change. It did, and that sort of was the root of the column. The way that went down is that my understanding is when PJ initially talked to, I don't want to say investigators because I'm not sure that's the proper term, but it is, you get the point. Whenever the people who were asking in an official way about this, whether they were people from North Carolina or people from the NCAA, he gave answers when asked about the use of rental cars and all this stuff and his connection to this person and that person and whatever. He gave answers. And if you took those answers at face value, if you just said whatever PJ Hairston tells us is the truth, then you would have concluded from that that the truth isn't that bad. It's wrong. It's violations. Shouldn't have been doing it. But it's not something that's going to end his college career. So that's why everybody was saying, hey, he'll be back. It'll be fine. Subsequent to that, North Carolina and or the NCAA became aware, either with undeniable proof or enough through enough conversations with other people, that he wasn't honest with them. That if he said he used a rental car, and again, I'm just throwing these dates and numbers out there, don't hold me to them, but this is, you'll get the point. If he said, I only had the rental car on this day and in that week and in on that day, it was actually 10 times that. Like he wasn't honest. And so when North Carolina people were saying, yes, we think he'll be back, they were basing that on what he had told them and on what they thought they knew at that time. Subsequently, they found out that he was not telling them the truth, that there was way more stuff going on here than they realized before, than he acknowledged before, at which point you've got a worse situation as it pertains strictly to impermissible benefits, but you also have what could be, if you really wanted to trump it up, an unethical conduct charge for essentially doing what Des Bryant did, which is when we ask you questions, you better tell us the truth. And he didn't. I don't want to call him a liar because it's such a harsh word, so I'll just keep it consistent. He did not tell them the truth. And once they found out he did not tell them the truth initially, they knew that he was never going to play college basketball again, at which point they all move on. And I just think, you know, it made total sense to me. And I was, though the backlash from what I wrote on Friday was small. Most people agree. There were still some people going, how could you not blame North Carolina for not fighting for him? Jay Billis, somebody we all respect and is very smart, said, North Carolina should have at least, you know, given PJ Hairston his day in court. And I get that, I guess. If you just wanted to run through the process and say,
go through the motions. Yeah.
Yeah, and go. But at the end of the day, the result was going to be the result. You know, once you're not honest with the NCAA when they ask you questions and they know that you weren't, on top of all the impermissible benefits, you're done. Like it was just going. It was always going to end the same. And so I just think the smart move for North Carolina was, you know, for actual reasons, and then for the possible reasons that Norlander referenced, just the psychology of putting it all behind you. I think it was the smart, intelligent way to go.
I agree. So I'm just intrigued by what UNC is going to be for the next 2 months. I just, to me, they're fascinating in just their unpredictable nature. You know, looked good, I guess, as they could have with McDonald coming back against Texas, given who they are. But yeah, they'll just be a mystery, and we're probably gonna talk about them on this podcast almost every week, given their relevance and the up and down nature that will be this season with
them. Let's talk some actual on the court stuff now. Let's start with a wild game from Saturday night, and I didn't really expect it to be a wild game. I sort of sat around the house on Saturday watching games, whether it was the Texas Michigan State game that led into Ohio State and Notre Dame. And there was a moment, we had some friends, oh, it's bad weather, like tornado warnings and stuff, and some friends of ours, electricity was out. So we were like, okay, just come over here because our stuff's fine. So they brought their kids over. And I was sort of distracted and watching the game. And I was about to change the channel and just, or at the very least, like communicate with the people who were in our home rather than keep watching the game. it was, they were up 8.
Don't go being social, GP.
I know. I was, listen, they were, I was as social as I could be, right? Whatever. What do you want me to do? It was Saturday night and I was watching basketball. And so Ohio State was down 8 points with 51 seconds left. They close on, I think, a 14-3 run, beat Notre Dame. I won't ask if you've ever seen anything like that before, because with YouTube, we've all seen stuff like this before. But Norlander, you went out of your way to, I thought was really good, and there were some moments there that I just did not remember, to talk about some of the biggest collapses. But this was about, I mean, we get thousands of games every year. This was very, very rare. You see somebody down 8 with less than a minute to play, you don't win that game.
Yeah. For anyone listening that might not have seen this, and if you, you know, want to get away from your family for 30 minutes sometime over Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, whatever, it's on the site, Classic Collapses in Recent College Basketball History. And I basically wanted to compare what Notre Dame did on Saturday night to anything similar, just basically since Duke did it to Maryland in 01, which I think is the most famous example of any collapse in the regular season. I think Arizona, Illinois in the 05 tournament probably has the all-time memorable collapse medal, if you will. So I looked it up, and what was interesting was I asked Twitter. I was like, anyone that knows, I want an eight-point lead or more with 60 seconds or less to go, because, you know, collapses happen all the time in college basketball, whether you're up, you know, 14 in the final 5 minutes and you lose it. But I wanted to know teams that actually, like, with less than a minute to go, just vomited away a lead and ended up losing. And yeah, it was crazy in terms of how few. I mean, I think I had 9 over the course of the past 13 seasons. And most of these, I was talking with Borzello on G-Chat, like, well, not most, like half of these I have had no idea happened, like no memory whatsoever, like not even jogging, like, yeah, I think that might have happened. No, I just straight up didn't remember. And the most amazing thing to me was on February 12th, 2005, two of them happened. And there's only been like 9 since 2001. So for those to fall on the same date is pretty remarkable. And the probably it's the best one or the most unlikely was Vegas beating San Diego State 93-91 on February 12th, 05, and they came back. They were down by 10 with like 18 seconds to go and did not foul and ended up winning the game. So that ended up going to OT and UNLV won.
I did not remember that game. I just didn't remember it, right? But I watched the YouTube video that you posted. And so it starts with, you look at the clock, it's like 18 point something like that, right? And they're down 10. And you go, okay, you know that they're about to come back because like that's why the stupid video is posted. But like you sit there and you go, how could this possibly happen? Like,
right.
Like how could you possibly overcome this deficit in 20 seconds? It was a ridiculous thing to watch.
Yeah, no, it was. That's actually kind of the fun of the post. If you can see it, there's 4 or 5 videos posted. So you know they're coming. You can take a walk down memory lane, or you can just watch how it happens. And probably that one is certainly a standout one. I've got the Illinois-Arizona game on there as well. But yeah, just it was, you know, for Notre Dame to do that and to be involved, by the way, in two of these games on both ends of them in less than a year's time on the calendar, because it was last year when they played Louisville in kind of that hideous Saturday night ESPN game. And Louisville was up, like, you know, it was in the low 50s. Notre Dame rallied in the final minute to send it to overtime and ended up going to 5 overtimes. And here we go. Here's a nice little segue. They end up winning, Notre Dame does, over Louisville, thanks to Jerrion Grant, who is now off the team. There's something about Notre Dame and star players, because they had their quarterback, and Golston had academic issues, and now Jerrion Grant off of Notre Dame, which is obviously huge, because I honestly don't think they're a tournament team now without him.
Notre Dame, correct me if I'm wrong, Borzello, They should look into creating an academic environment where their players don't have to cheat.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't that save
a lot of trouble?
Yeah, I mean, instead of losing your star players, you know, every season, you know, that would be a good thing to look into.
Yeah, like, hey, Notre Dame, if you listen, loosen things up a little bit so your players can stop cheating, or at the very least,
start throwing things under the rug, right?
stop catching them for crying out loud. This is it's becoming embarrassing. It is actually becoming a little bit of a story. Like when this story broke yesterday, I had people on Twitter going, another typical Notre Dame athlete, and I want to go, well, I don't think you know what typical means, because it's like 2, right, or 3, like that you can remember. So it's not typical. It's the opposite of typical. But it does start to, you know, whether it's Everett Golston or now Jerrion Grant, people start to connect all these stories, and they go, oh God, a Notre Dame athlete getting called academic issue again. You know, just like that's all they do, and it's not all they do. Like on some level, it's pretty impressive that Notre Dame is shown as an institution of higher learning that it will not tolerate stuff that quite clearly other universities will tolerate. In fact, other universities will create on their own. But and so it's actually impressive for Notre Dame, except it doesn't play that way with your casual sports fan. It looks like Notre Dame's running some place where all the players are cheating, when in fact, what we're finding out is that Notre Dame's actually running a real university, it seems. But
where if you cheat, you get in trouble.
Where if you cheat, you get in trouble. And it doesn't matter if you're the leading scorer for the basketball team or the quarterback of the football team. If you cheat, you get in trouble, and we will remove you from school. But to the casual fan, it's like, oh, all the Notre Dame players are up there cheating. It just, it's a weird sort of conclusion that I think casual fans draw from these incidents.
I agree, and I wonder
when they found out about it. Personally,
it wasn't after Saturday night's game,
right?
And so, yeah. Well, clearly, what happened is they know that he'll be no longer allowed to play once the second semester begins,
yeah,
or the first semester officially ends, whichever it is. And they just decided they're going to play him up to the final minute, you know, that they can.
Yeah.
That's not usually the way schools do it. I remember when I was the beat writer for Memphis, they had just a disaster of a team one year. It was the preseason top 20. Sean Banks came back for his sophomore year when he probably should have turned pro. Definitely, in hindsight, should have turned pro. But they were bringing back this experienced team that had gone to the tournament, and the only thing they had lost was Antonio Burks, the point guard. They're bringing in Darius Washington to play point guard. They were supposed to preseason top 15. They were supposed to be really good, and it was a mess from beginning to end. Sean Banks came back like I think he was high at the first practice, probably overweight, just like a mess, bad, like all the stuff, bad stuff you'd heard about him in high school. It somehow it was there when he came back for his sophomore year. And he became academically ineligible. And they played him literally to the final second that he could actually play. And the only reason I remember this is because it became like a big like fight between me and the Memphis staff, because they were mad at me because I was writing that they had known he had been was going to be ineligible for 2 weeks. And they kept playing him, which is fine. That's essentially what Mike Bray has done. There's nothing wrong with that. But what John Calipari kept trying to say every time he was, in a press conference, he would say, listen, we did everything we could. And keep in mind, these are two different issues. Jerry and Grant, it seems like, had an academic issue, which suggests, like, you know, cheating on some level, yeah. Right? Whereas
the way he explained it seemed like it was some sort of cheating. He's like, you know, I knew the rules. I did this one thing. It was my decision, blah, blah, blah.
Right. With Sean Banks, he was like, he just failed classes, right? He didn't pass enough courses to remain eligible. And so every time John would hold a press conference and talk about Sean Banks, he would say, listen, folks, you have to understand, we did everything we could do for the kid. We would walk. What are you supposed to do when you have an assistant coach walk him to class, like actually walk him to class, and then when the class starts and the assistant coach leaves, the kid gets up and walks out of class. What are you supposed to do? And so I would always, being a young, inquisitive reporter, I would go, well, you could have benched him. You know, you could have like not let him play a game. Well, what do you mean? Well, like if you knew that he was leaving class, then or not going, like why not just suspend him? Because he played every game that year. You know, he played every game. He was never like really suspended or dismissed from the team or whatever. And it would be like, I guess where we would butt heads is they would say, we did everything we could do. And I would say, no, you didn't. You quite clearly didn't. You know, you could have, in theory, had an assistant. I bet you a professor, particularly one at the University of Memphis, wouldn't have minded if you had an assistant coach stand in the back of the lecture hall and make sure Sean Banks can't leave. Like, it's fine. You know, Sean Banks is an idiot. He flunked out of school. You played him to the last possible minute that you could. That's all fine. Just don't tell me, you can hear me re-arguing this again, just don't tell me that you did everything you could do, because you didn't do everything you could do. But I guess what I'm saying is, that's the only other time I can remember a player playing until the last possible minute he would be eligible to play. In other words, Sean Banks that day, it was like a Saturday afternoon game. He was on the court when the buzzer sounded, game over. That night, on a weekend, like same deal, Saturday night, I reported that he was going to be ineligible for the second semester. It was a lot like the Jerry and Grant thing, which is, so when I read it Sunday, people were like, so did you just find out about it Sunday morning? No, they've known about it. They just made a decision. Okay, this is
to play him until he couldn't play.
We're just going
to
use him as long as we can use him, which is whatever. I don't have a problem with that, actually. I know some people might, but it doesn't bother me. Porzello, you on board with Norlander here? You don't think Notre Dame can make the tournament without him?
I think they can, just because the ACC is not very good, and I still think with what they have, I mean, it's crazy to say the ACC is not very good, but outside of Syracuse and Duke, who's clearly better than Notre Dame on paper? You know, I don't know if there's a clear-cut third-place team. I mean, if you count UNC, you can say who's fourth, but you know, they're going to have to make changes. I mean, they can't play the four-guard lineup, obviously, anymore. They're going to have to go to a bigger lineup. They're going to have to use their freshmen, you know, Beecham and Vistoria more. I don't think they're going to burn their red shirt for Cameron Bashad. But, you know, they're going to have to change up what they do. And I don't know if they're a lock NCAA tournament team, but, you know, it's I think they might make it. I know it's not going out on a limb, but just because of the ACC, I still think they're probably a fifth or sixth best team in the ACC without Jerian Grant. And just because Mike Bray, he's done this before when they've lost players midseason, he completely changes the style and it works. So I have faith in him for now, but it's a huge loss. I mean, he was their leading scorer, leading assist man, their go-to guy, you know, sort of their leader. It's an enormous loss.
It'll be the first time in five seasons that they don't make it, if they don't make it. And just for anyone listening, the only good win they have is over Indiana, which will probably be a tournament team, but obviously not the world beaters they were last year. And so, they've lost to Indiana State, Iowa, North Dakota State, and then Ohio State. So, yeah, they'll probably have to pick up some serious, serious wins in the ACC, which also is randomly, and maybe it's not that random, just our expectations were out of whack. It's not nearly the league we thought it would be.
Here's one for you. Somebody was asking me the other day on Twitter. Obviously, at this point, Arizona is the consensus number one, and they should be, based on resume, based on roster, based on preseason expectations. Arizona should be number one in the country. Would you take them over anybody on a neutral court right now? Forget records and resumes and all that stuff. Who would you, if we started a 16 team tournament tomorrow and we put whatever's best 16 teams, you think who would you pick to win it? Who do you think's the best team in the country right now?
I think it's Arizona. If I had to pick a champion for March or April or whatever, I wouldn't pick them. Starting tomorrow, I would pick them just because. Right now, I think they're playing by far the best basketball in the country. I know, you know, they're one of, 10 undefeated teams left. But, you know, defensively, they're so good, and they have so many weapons offensively. Right now, if you're going to start a 16 tournament tomorrow and you're in your little hypothetical, I think I'd pick Arizona.
If they're fully healthy, I'm probably – I like Arizona a lot, and it would be splitting hairs, but I'd probably take Michigan State, who looked awesome at Texas. And the more I watch that team, they're not perfect, but man, I can't remember a Tom Izzo team that was this well-rounded, this fun to watch on offense, and this entertaining. I mean, it's been a long time.
I don't know if I would pick Michigan State among my top four teams right now.
Really? Okay. If they're fully healthy, I really like what they have. I mean, they have a lot of open options offensively, and you know, Valentine is the kind of guy that I think a lot of teams don't have. I think Trice could be the best backup point guard in the nation. And, you know, Costello's not healthy right now. But when you have everything there, I just really like their potential come March.
As I was thinking about this, I obviously have Arizona ranked number one. And so I was like, okay, yeah, probably Arizona. But what it shows me, or at least what I think, where we're sitting right now, there are about four or five, maybe even six, seven, eight teams that feel like they're teams that should be ranked third in the country. But there's not a true number one. A team that has that number one feel. Like when I look at Arizona, I go, that's a really good team. Like that's a Final Four caliber team. But I don't go, typically in years, there's this one team where you go, man, I'll be surprised if they're not in the Final Four. Like, I'll be surprised if Carolina with Hansborough and Ty Lawson, if that team's not in the Final Four, that'll be surprising to me. The Anthony Davis, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist team at this time, that year, you were already like, you know, if they're not in the Final Four, that would surprise me. That's a great basketball team. There's nobody right now that if they didn't make the Final Four, I'd go, wow, I can't believe that. Like, there's just a bunch of really good teams or a handful of really good teams, but I don't know that there's really a great one. Is there a great team right now?
No, I mean, you could have said any one of, like, 10 teams for that question you just asked. And you can, like, make an argument against it or for it. And I would be like, all right, like you could have picked Oklahoma State, and that's okay. That's fine.
I could have said Florida. You'd have been like, okay. Yeah, I could say.
But do we at least acknowledge that like the collective ability of these teams is at a higher level than in a few years past when people, it's almost feel like, and there are exceptions, but it's like, oh, there's no great team in college basketball. But at least this year, it's actually like, you know, 6 to 7 to 8 teams that are like really, really awesome. Just they had, there's not like one particularly amazing team that's been able to separate itself.
I don't know if there's 6 or 7 that are really, really awesome. You know, like, but like
6 or 7 teams that could win the title. You know, something
well,
like that.
That's every year. I think there's. Yeah. I think Arizona's really good. I think Syracuse is really good. I think Wisconsin's really good, and they're still fighting that Wisconsin sort of perception a little bit, but and they will until they get into March and advance to a Final Four or an Elite Eight or something like that. But I think they're really good. I think Oklahoma State's good. I think Florida is better probably than where they're ranked right now because they took some losses while they were banged up and so I think there's probably 5, 6, 7 teams that
okay,
are
okay. So here's and it's so awesome you did that because this is what I was going to lead into. Ohio State's still undefeated. They barely escaped Notre Dame with that exit. 12-0 team, but they aren't really getting any sort of respect in terms of being a top 5 team, despite the fact that they're obviously there in the rankings. I feel like a lot of people don't think this is a team that's worthy of a Final Four.
Now, here's what happens. People don't think of them. And because I think typically for you to be a college basketball team that gets attention, you have to do one of two things. You either have to be a team that beats somebody that we also think is great. Right. So Villanova's completely off the radar. Then they beat Kansas and it's like, whoa, OK, now what's going on there? Yeah. Baylor completely off the radar. They knock out Colorado, then they knock out Kentucky and we go, OK, what's going on there? You got to register like significant wins. And Ohio State to date, though they got Marquette early, Marquette doesn't appear to be as good as we thought Marquette was. And they really haven't, you know, and then Notre Dame is just, you know, that's a team that lost to Indiana State. So they haven't been able to register a win. All right, so
like people have seen Ohio State probably twice. Like their two biggest games were at Marquette and then the Notre Dame game. So that's when people saw the Marquette game was hideous.
It is.
It was one of the worst offensive games we've seen all year. And then the Notre Dame game, I mean, most people would say, okay, they probably should have lost that game.
Yeah.
So those two games, you're going to say, is Ohio State that good?
They
like,
shape you a little bit. But then you go, okay, who have they really beat? Like, who have they really beat? And the answer is like, not really anybody. Okay, so to me, in college basketball, that's the way you really get attention where people start talking about you. You go out and you beat, like Oklahoma State just ran Memphis off the court that first week, second week of the season. That's everybody goes, whoa, what is going on at Oklahoma State? It's because they had a significant win, impressive win over a team that people also think is good. Okay, so that's one way. The other way is to just have a great player. You know, just have a Marcus Smart or a Julius Randle or a Jabari Parker or, you know, somebody who is throwing up big, big numbers. And so when you look at Ohio State, they don't check either of those boxes. They don't have the big wins that make people pay attention, and they don't have the great individual player that makes people pay attention. Aaron Kraft is terrific, right? But he's not going to be a guy who's throwing up the type of numbers that makes people, you know, sort of go, whoa, what's happening? You know, he's a rock solid, really good. I would love for him to play point guard on my team, but he's not going to go out and get 30 and 10, like Adrian Payne threw up 33 and 9 the other night. Aaron Kraft's never going to have a game like that. And so I think Ohio State, while one of the great athletic departments in the country and biggest schools in the country, and when it comes to athletics, is operating a little bit like off the radar right now for those reasons.
Yeah, I agree mostly. And I mean, Kraft, obviously, so much of what he does is on the defensive end. And Borzell and I talked plenty about him on Jason McIntyre's podcast, just the perceptions of Kraft and Ohio State. And but they're number one team defensively in the country, and they get Michigan State on the road January 7th. So that'll be their game parish you were talking about in terms of getting a high profile win. If they can go at Michigan State and win it there, and if they were undefeated after that point, which they very well will be when they enter it, because they get Louisiana, Monroe, then Purdue, then Nebraska. You know, we're getting there with Ohio State. They just don't have the schedule.
The biggest issue with them is that I think that to call them a Final Four team or whatever is that you're banking on LaQuinton Ross being their go-to guy, and I think it's a lot of faith in LaQuinton Ross to kind of carry them offensively through, because they don't have a ton of offensive firepower. So it comes down to LaQuinton Ross to, I guess, carry the load and be their go-to guy, and I don't know if he can do it consistently.
All right, before I let you go, I want to look ahead a little bit to Saturday, because it's actually turned out to be, we always thought it was just going to be a great day because of Kentucky-Louisville. It's actually going to be a great doubleheader now. Because you get undefeated Villanova, undefeated Syracuse, two top 5 teams, you know, early afternoon, and then Kentucky-Louisville late afternoon. I want to talk about the Kentucky-Louisville thing specifically, though, because there was a quote recently from Kevin Ware. I think it was Kevin Ware about the rivalry. Okay. And he basically downplayed the rivalry between Louisville and Kentucky. He said, we're bored with it. We don't really understand it. I'm paraphrasing, but that was essentially his point of view. And people were like, whoa, what is it? Like, it genuinely made national headlines. And this is something that I've thought is interesting for a while. Because, you know, to the extent, the reason something is a rivalry typically is because, say, you know, the fans, you know, it's a rivalry because of geography. And, you know, Mississippi State and Ole Miss can be rivals. Ohio State and Michigan can be rivals. UCLA and USC can be rivals. And it's a lot of it's rooted in they've played each other forever. And because, your neighbors probably went to one school, you went to the other. Your wife might have went to one school, you went to the other. And so the coaches might not like each other because they've both been in place for a while recruiting against each other. And so rivalries make sense to me from the perspective of coaches, from the perspective of fans, from the perspective of faculty. But when you bring a kid in from, say, Chicago and move him to the state of Kentucky, like, I can completely understand why he might not hate Kentucky or might not hate Louisville. Like, he didn't grow up a part of that rivalry. His parents didn't go to either one of the schools. His neighbors didn't go to either one of the schools. And so where people were sort of, I guess, taken back by that a little bit, I thought it made perfect sense. I think these rivalries are huge to everybody except the players. I don't think the players, they're aware of it, but the idea that Julius Randle growing up in the state of Texas has some sort of disdain for the University of Louisville, that would be weirder to me than what Kevin Ware said.
Yeah, no, Borzello can speak to the mindset of a lot of these guys because he obviously knows them so well from the AU circuit. But this is almost the great unsaid between players and fans, and this goes on the college level. I think it goes on the pro level a lot because he's, you know, more and more players are, and in a lot of ways this is really good, they know each other, they're friendly with each other. There's a certain downside to it. Like, I genuinely love when a rivalry on the court or on the field has genuine venom to it, because it does add that layer of drama that I think really enhances it. But overall, fans care so much more than the players. Like, they don't, get me wrong, you know, especially at the pro level, it's their livelihood, but they're really able to compartmentalize a lot of this stuff, just like everyone else at their job compartmentalizes going to work and then going home. And so rarely do we hear players talk out of school about, you know, this rivalry really just doesn't mean all that much to me, because they don't want to tick off the fan base. Obviously they want to endear themselves to the fans, but Ware is right on the money, and the rivalry exists for the fans more than anyone. And we're lucky with Kentucky and Louisville that Calipari and Patino certainly are oil and water in that respect, and that's also helped that specific rivalry. But more than anything, he's right on. I mean, these players don't grow up. I mean, the way he said it, by the way, it's on our site. If you just search the headline on Google, Kevin Ware, Kentucky Louisville rivalry, it's funny because he's so clearly honest. He's like, dude, I'm kind of bored with it. And by the way, guys, all respect to the players for having to endure that Kentucky media with this kind of stuff, because they're getting the same questions over and over. And so Ware at a certain point was just like, dude, we're bored by it. I don't really care. Most of the guys aren't even here from Kentucky. It's just another game for us, you know. And then he had a nice little, you know, unintentional dig where he's like, to us, you know, Kentucky doesn't even really exist outside of this game.
Well, when's the last time there was like a physical altercation in the rivalry? I mean, like,
DeMarcus Cousins tried to.
Yeah, that's
when I remember. Outside of that, has there been?
Well, no, I just think it's not exclusive to this. I mean, I'm not saying players can't care about rivalries. Like, I guess if you get the Texas Oklahoma game, you know, football game.
Yeah,
you'll get a bunch of Texas players playing for Texas and a bunch of Texas players playing for Oklahoma, and they all grew up in it, I guess. You know, and so I'm not pretending that it doesn't exist. Like, you know, like Florida State, you're going to get a bunch of Florida kids on each side. They grew up in it. you know, their parents probably were part of it at some, like, that all makes sense to me. But in this one specifically, where it's, you have a Louisville roster with a bunch of kids who aren't from Kentucky, and a Kentucky roster with a bunch of kids who aren't from Kentucky, why on earth, and, you know, they're only, they, it's not like you spend 4 years getting to understand the rivalry. These days, you get, you know, 8 months, you're a part of the rivalry. You play Louisville one time, you play Kentucky one time, and then you're off to the NBA. Like, I as I read that quote, I was like, that makes total sense to me. Why would Kevin Ware be, you know, have some sort of inherent hatred towards the University of Kentucky? That would be so weird. He probably didn't even know where Lexington was 3 years ago. You know, so I think there are scenarios under which the rivalries can be massive. You know, Ohio State and Michigan in football, where there's a bunch of kids who grew up in that rivalry actually on the field. But Kentucky Louisville, like, I haven't looked at the rosters. The overwhelming majority of the players, almost all of them, that you're going to see on the court on Saturday, they didn't grow up a part of this rivalry. Some of them picked Louisville because they wanted to play for Rick Pitino. Some of them picked Kentucky because they wanted to play for John Calipari. And then, of course, whatever role Nike and Adidas might have played in these decisions. And that's the extent of it. They don't hate Louisville or hate Kentucky. They're just basketball players.
Borzella, do you think because of AAU, mostly rivalries on the court, player to player, aren't nearly as intense as they were 15, 20, 25 years ago? Because you hear commentators, guys that balled in the 70s and 80s, and they said it used to, you know, who knows if this is just nostalgia or them talking it up, but they say it used to be, certainly, there was a lot more pride in us versus you, my team versus your team, but obviously with AAU, seeing these guys plenty, you know, 2-3 years before they get to college, sometimes sharing rosters and then going to different schools in general. Doesn't
like
it feel like
friends.
This is more?
They probably text each other.
Yeah, right. So it's just more from the it's more that the media kind of, and that's fine. Yeah. But I mean, we're just inflating what's actually out there.
I think that's probably true. But listen, we've taken enough time here. So let me wrap this up by telling you guys thank you and wishing you a Merry Christmas or whatever it is, whatever holiday you might celebrate. It's wild now. You don't even know what to wish people anymore. So just
just a Merry Christmas. By the way, are you rocking 2 Christmas trees again, GP?
Oh God, true. I wish we had 2.
You have like 6, right?
Yeah, like we have more Christmas trees than we should. We have I think it is around 6. I don't know. Like the whole
I know you're not going to cut down 6 trees. So how are you even getting 6 trees into your house?
Oh well, they're all fake. They're all fake trees.
Okay.
Yeah. So like my thing is like that's great. Like you're putting, you know, we put all these up. That's terrific. But like somebody's got to take these down, you know. And we have a baby due like literally any day. So I can just see a scenario under which like, you know, we have Christmas trees up till like February because like nobody has time to take them down or nobody's capable of taking them down. I guess what I'm frustrated by is that responsibility is going to fall on me almost certainly, and I don't like putting stuff up.
Well, you're not a fan of manual labor. You never have been.
Yeah. So we have a bunch of Christmas trees.
Are you a fan of manual labor, Norlander?
Yeah. Are you a fan of manual labor?
Like you like that?
I'm not averse to it, guys. Okay. Like you too. All right. Borzello, have you ever even pumped your own gas?
Yeah, I had to pump my own gas. I didn't know how to do it until college, but I've done it since then. I've never mowed a lawn or anything like that. I don't know how to change a tire. I call people and they do it for me.
I changed a tire in Starkville, Mississippi at 1 in the morning after a Kentucky-Mississippi State game a couple of seasons ago. I got back to my car, you know, late at night. You leave an arena later than everybody else. And when you're in Starkville, Mississippi, there ain't much going on. You know, on a Wednesday, Tuesday night at 1 a.m., there's not much happening. And it was like, I didn't know who to call. I didn't know what to do. And I just decided I could probably do this myself. I was there like 90 minutes trying to change a single tire. Most frustrated I've ever been in my life. I almost just started crying right there in the middle of campus.
Are we going to be able to talk like about your kid on next week's podcast? Are we going to be able to
get into it? I am not sure about that. Well, first, I've under, tell me if this is weird or not. I'm under instructions not to say the actual due date because, okay. But here's why. Because she has a memory of when our first son was born, of sort of coming to and being clear-minded in the hospital and then recognizing that her mom had already held our son and my mom had already held our son and my dad had already held our son and all this stuff. And the thought of that infuriates her. So she now wants, with this birth, to not have anybody at the hospital other than us. In other words, at some point, her plan is that we will call our family and say, rather than call the family and say, hey, we're on our way to the hospital, she wants to call the family maybe like 7 hours after the baby's born and say, hey, we are at the hospital and the baby was born 7 hours ago and you guys can come up here if you would like. She doesn't want anybody at the hospital or anybody waiting on the baby. So I'm not, it's strict. You could waterboard me and I would not be able to tell you when this baby is going to be born.
I mean, she's the mom. It's her call. That's totally cool. Well, here's
what you learn. And I didn't learn. I haven't always taken this approach to the relationship or to anything really. At some point, particularly with a pregnant woman, you just have to give up. Like, it doesn't matter you think about. We at one point were arguing over debating names, and we'd pick the middle name, but I mean we'd pick the first name, had not been able to settle on a middle, and she settled. And then I went to the Old Spice Classic, and I came home and she had decided on the middle. All right. That's sort of the way that happened. And not only had decided, she had started monogramming things with the name on it. And so I said, well, listen, I don't really like that middle name. And she was like, well, you said you liked that name. I said, no. I said I liked, I'll just tell you what the names are. It's fine. Oliver is the first name and the middle name is Carter. So it's going to be Oliver Carter Parrish, right? And
I said, OCP.
OCP. And so I said, we're naming our kid after Oliver Purnell. I don't think people realize that. It's
now I'm picturing a baby Oliver Purnell.
God, hey, I would love to have a baby Oliver Purnell. and so I said, listen, here's what I actually said. I said we were going over first names, and I said I like the name Oliver, and I said I like the name Carter. I never said I like the name Oliver Carter Parrish. That's not what I said. Yes, you did. Well, no, I did. Like, I know what I said. Like, I like the name Oliver. Like, Oliver Parrish, I like that. Carter Parrish, I like that. But I didn't. I never
Carter Parrish sounds ballin'. I like that.
I thought so too, right? And so I said, I like that. But I didn't like Oliver Carter Parrish. Yes, you did. Okay, listen. No, I've already got something monogrammed. Okay, let's talk about that for a second. Why would you do that? First off, because the baby's not gonna be here for a while. Secondly, how big of a deal is that? Well, it says OCP. Okay, well, how much did that cost? She said like $50. I said, okay. Let me ask you a question. Are we really gonna tie ourselves to a name that I don't like based off of $50? Because we spend $50 on dumber stuff than that every single day. So like can't we just
like
chalk it up
as a six Christmas tree?
Yeah. So can we like just chalk it up as a $50 loss and be done? The name has been decided. You picked it. I'm like, okay, fine. I it can be decided because clearly I'm not winning this one. But you have to stop saying I picked it because I didn't. It's not.
So
what
now,
I did.
Now your kid knows right away that you don't like his name.
I know. So here's the point. I could have had that conversation forever, and logically speaking, I would have been on the right side of it forever, but I would never win in that. Ever. So same deal. It didn't really make a whole lot of sense for me to like keep the due date a secret, but like you realize, dude, if that's what she thinks is makes sense, you might as well just roll with it, because trying to convince her that it doesn't make sense is it's the same as trying to seek reinstatement for PJ Harrison. It is a big waste of time. You ain't getting anywhere. And so I say all that to say, I'm not sure what we'll be talking about on next Monday's podcast. I can neither confirm nor deny that the baby should or should not be here by then. But if so, and if I'm available, then we'll see what happens. Either way, I look forward to it. So Christmas in North Carolina and Christmas in Connecticut. Is that the way you guys are doing it?
I fly back to New York on Christmas. I do it every year.
Yeah, you do that every year, Borzell. You fly on Christmas.
I don't mind
but it's always dead, right? So you don't care.
Yeah, it's
right?
Not bad.
Yeah, no, yeah, I do. I'm doing Eve at the in-laws, and then early afternoon, and then I go to my parents' place. They're about 45 minutes apart, so we'll do that deal.
I'm actually hoping the baby comes on Christmas. That way,
Christmas baby,
not Christmas Eve, because then that messes up Santa Claus for the other kid and all that, right? You don't want to get involved in that. But Christmas Day, Like, it just avoids all the, like, you have to bounce around. I don't know how you guys do it. All of our family is here. My family, her family.
So yeah, same.
So on Christmas Day, we typically wake up and, you know, you hang out here for a little while and then you got to bounce to, like, all right, we got to be at this house at 2 and then at this house at 5 and then this house at 7. And it's just like, it's like the worst.
It sounds terrible.
I don't want to. That's what we bounce to. But why aren't you, like, I see, I got a few buddies here that have a couple of kids and they said they used to do that with one, but once they got the second, it was like they became the central location, and so everyone had to come to them. Why don't you work on doing that, man?
It's same premise as before, because once my father has decided, or my mother has decided, like they seem to think their homes, like my mother really gets excited about having
that is a mom thing.
They want people at their home, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, I've actually floated out there, like my grandmother, like, really enjoys having people at her home. And so I'm like, listen, why don't we have people at our home? Like, you know, we have room, and, you know, we have TVs that you can, you know, we have like a room upstairs you can sneak away to if you want. Like, it's actually really ideal. But there's something to be like, I think there's people in my family who like saying, everybody's been over here for Christmas for the past 42 years. You know, they like get off on that. And so you don't disrupt it. You just sort of do what you got to do. But if you're wondering if it's a pain in the ass, it is a pain in the ass. So if we got to have this baby anyway, I say have it on Christmas Day around noon so that it eliminates all of the bouncing around all day Christmas Day, right?
That'd be a little solid for OCP to do for you on Christmas. We'll see.
Little baby Oliver Purnell.
Dude, that's a good one. He's never gonna get fired, man. You've already started. He's gonna lead a life of not getting fired.
If he grows up to get paid $2 million to coach at DePaul, I'll be thrilled with him. I can't wait. All right, well, so subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. It's the quickest way to get your hands on the podcast each and every week. Enjoy Christmas. Enjoy the week.
Merry Christmas, guys.
And we will
and
not
to the listeners.
Yeah, Merry Christmas to everybody.
Happy holidays.
Not gonna do a podcast later on this week because there's nothing going on between now and say Thursday, Friday, and or very little going on, and like it's family time. Here's what I believe: nobody should be talking on a podcast over the Christmas holidays, and nobody should be listening to a podcast over the Christmas holidays. So knock this out today or tomorrow, and enjoy time with your family. And we will talk again a little later on.